Hey, and welcome back to another season of Skillscape. I'm so excited to do this, and I hope that you're as excited as I am, because today we have Adam, who co-founded Siri. Yup, that's Siri on your phone and my phone and on billions of devices today. He also co-founded Viv Labs, which is basically Siri 2.0, sold that to Samsung for more than $200 million. He was also part of the founding team of Change.org, the world's largest social petition website. First of all, a biggest thank you to Gavin Teo from Altara Ventures, Fionn Lerm from Time Auction, and Philip Lam from Home Court, all of whom are advisors to the podcast and have been a huge, huge anchor of support. Another big thank you to Idenjon, HQ's premier incubator, and has supported the podcast all the way through till today. And finally, a big thank you to the guests of the show, the audience, and Michelle Lam, who has been very instrumental and supportive throughout this podcasting journey. Enjoy this episode, and I'll see you next time. Welcome to Adam. Thank you so much for coming in on the podcast. I'm really excited to finally be able to have this chat with you. You know, from our conversation last time, I've still got so many questions left unanswered, and big welcome to you today. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you, Justin. Glad to be here.
Awesome. To kick things off, could you give us a quick introduction to yourself, your experiences with founding, you know, multiple startups, and you know, where you're at right now?
Sure. So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a researcher. I've been an executive at some of the larger companies, but I'm best known for starting four companies. One is Siri, which sold to Apple. It's been on billions of devices. I did a Siri 2.0 company called Viv Labs, which sold to Samsung, and it's on hundreds of millions of devices. I was a founding member and first developer at Change.org, the world's largest petition platform. We just crossed more than 450 million members a few weeks ago. And another company called Sentient, AI machine learning company at scale, which sold to Cognizant.
Awesome. To anchor this discussion, because I do really want to dive into, you know, Siri's success and really how you've been able to scale the product to, you know, millions and billions of people. Let's start with a very simple question. What was the original value proposition of Siri, and what pain point was Siri, you know, really meant to solve?
Sure. So this was 2007 when we started a company. And at the time, Google was probably the dominant technology company. But we saw a number of open space areas, problems that could not be solved with existing technology. First of all, when you type something into Google, especially in 2007, it just gives you back links. And then you had to go wading through link after link and trying to aggregate this information. Siri would actually get a job done. So we actually had the domain name doengine.com. We said, if you want to get to a document, go to a search engine. But if you're trying to accomplish a task like order me a pizza or make a reservation at a French restaurant tomorrow night for three people, you would actually get this done through Siri. So Siri was powered not by documents like a search engine. It was powered by an ecosystem of web services that could not only get you live data, but could also perform actions and tasks on your behalf. And of course, the interface was quite different. Siri was conversational, so you could have follow-up queries like, how about tomorrow? What about the next day? And it could come back and ask you queries if it needed additional information. So it was really a different experience for getting things done. Mm.
And back then, were there any sort of like competitors that were doing similar things, or you know other companies that might have been sort of just challenging or also, you know, going for the whole voice assistant conversation kind of solution that you were trying to provide with Siri? And how did you retain your competitive advantage?
So really, voice speech recognition existed, but it was only used in a few ways. It was used for dictation. So there were products like Dragon Dictate and others that instead of having to type, you could dictate an email, for instance, and it would just record your voice, but it couldn't understand those words and act on it. There was a company called Lingo, which did voice search. So rather than type in a keyword into a search engine, you could speak a keyword and it would just put whatever you said into a search engine like Yahoo. They partnered with Yahoo and it would give you back link. But you didn't have to type it. And on a mobile phone, you know, that was an advantage. So conversational assistant paradigm, where the assistant actually understood what you were doing. There had been work on in research research labs, but there were no real commercial products before Siri. And that was the paradigm that we really introduced to the world and, you know, kind of set the standard. Now you look at Alexa or Google Assistant, all of those came after Siri. And once Siri showed that it could be done and that it was a desirable thing to do, it really set a new standard.
Right. You're right. It really did pave the way for a lot of innovation around that sphere. You mentioned something before, you know, how there was like, simple voice search, copy and paste, and also, you know, other things like a menu tree, a very simple menu tree.
Yeah.
Going into that whole really engineering Siri to become conversational and really understanding, you know, what the words meant. What was that process like?
So we had a new patented technology approach. So I was the advisor of a grad student. His name was Didier Guzzoni. And we worked together for a number of years on his technology. It wasn't only focused on natural language understanding and conversation. And people often mistake Siri as the only thing that it does or did. Interesting was that it could understand the words. But really, we had numerous AI technologies beautifully intertwined together so that it could understand what you were saying conversationally, but then it would know how to act in these dynamic combinations of services. So in the original Siri, if I said, get me a restaurant tomorrow night, you know, with a view of Golden Gate Park, 7 different services would dynamically collaborate and compete to answer your question. So you'd have open table reservation time, you'd have a Yelp review, photos from CityGrid. So it was this dynamic ecosystem of services that, yeah, I understand he wants a restaurant, but which services should be involved? And they all have, you know, different sets of restaurants with slightly different names or phone numbers. So it was a hard problem to actually handle the task and to coordinate all these dynamic set of services and to learn what the user's preferences were and how to shorten the time to task, how to help the user get the job done. To build a smart assistant, it wasn't just I understood it. I needed to be able to act on it and learn from those actions over time. And that was what Didier Guzzoni's thesis was. He won awards, we filed patents, and that was our unique approach that we went to VCs to try to raise money based on kind of his research or our research work and the prototypes that we had built as part of that.
Right. With Siri, you're essentially reducing that kind of barrier in terms of consumption. I did want to ask, did IP protection play a large role in maintaining this sort of edge over competition? Or you know, did it increase the appeal with investors at that time?
Sure. I think we were fundamentally a technology company. But being a technology company, any company that we're going to work with on distribution, either through partnership or acquisition, they're going to ask, is this technology protected? We had user interface methods that were novel on how to, for instance, have enhanced discovery. How can users know what they can say and what they can do and what they can't say or do? That's one of the biggest flaws of today's voice assistants is that obviously they can't do everything, but then they ask something that's out of scope, that's not in the set of capabilities that assistant knows how to do, and then it'll fail in a horrible way. And we had solved that with the original Siri app. When we launched 2010, we had like 95% accuracy on task completion. And it's like, well, why is that? Part of it was because we helped the user understand what was in scope and what was out of scope. So they were asking things that the assistant could do. That notion of discovery was another area that we patented. So yeah, IP protection was important. For any fundamental technology company, you need some breakthroughs. If you have something unique and important, you should patent it.
Right. On that note of the scope of what's possible and what's not possible with Siri, I do want to ask, what kind of really technical difficulties did you face when it came down to, you know, building the product and how did you overcome them?
So, you know, we came into it with basically a research prototype. One day we said, well, we need to ask for business names. I shouldn't be able to just say, find a French restaurant. I should be able to say, you know, make a reservation at Chez Louis or whatever. So we loaded in, we got a data set of, you know, US business names, loaded it into the system, and we realized that just about every word in the English language was a business name. Like, there's a business name for everything. And the ambiguities just completely exploded. And we had to dig ourselves out of the complexity introduced by, you know, doing fuzzy matching. Because, you know, you might have Joe's Bar and Tavern, and no one will call it that. They'll just say, oh, is Joe's Pub, make a reservation at Joe's Pub, right? You have to have fuzzy name matching on tens of millions of business names, and every word in the English language is a business name, to kind of crawl back and get our algorithms to be able to make sense of it. That was one of the biggest technical challenges. One example, if I say, book a 4-star restaurant in Boston. Immediately, you know what I mean. But if you think about it, book means, of course, not only like make a reservation, but it's also a physical book. And star is a city in the United States. And Boston's not only one city, there are 13 Bostons in the United States. So which city am I talking about? Book or star or one of the Bostons? And on, if you look at all the combinations and the ambiguities that your brain instantly knows what it means, you know, that's a really, really hard task. And that's what we were, you know, had to climb out and solve. So how did we do it? It was looking at data and just iterating and testing and tuning algorithms. Language is hard, but we managed to get it usable as long as you stayed within the domains that it knew how to do.
That's amazing. No, I think it does come down a lot, a huge part of it, to the user's, you know, adoption of the technology and knowing, you know, what's in that scope and what's out of the scope. What were some of the key considerations that you had, you know, when you were thinking about possible acquirers or even exits, and why did you end up choosing Apple?
Well, we were not thinking exit. We wanted distribution. And in fact, we had signed a deal with one of the major telcos, and they were going to preload Siri above the fold, meaning you turn on the phone and Siri logo will be there visible. And it was a major carrier in the US. And they were going to do primetime TV commercials and billboards. And we were excited about it. And then Steve Jobs literally called our office out of the blue and said, hey, it's Steve, come on over to my house tomorrow. What you doing? And we went there and he, you know, we talked for 3 hours about technology and the future and, you know, where AI is going. Lots of interesting discussions. And in that meeting, he made it clear he wanted to buy the company. And we said, no, we're not interested. Thank you. You know, we're flattered, but that's not our plan. Goodbye. And left. So we were not choosing an acquirer. We really wanted distribution, and it was how many devices do they have, and, you know, how many users and our target markets and things of that sort is what we were trying to optimize. But Steve Jobs came back about a month or two later with Scott Forstall and convinced us that, number one, we could change the world more with Apple than without. Number two, he really convinced us that he understood the full vision of what we were trying to do. This was not going to be just a little feature. This would be a major component of every interface that Apple produced. And we talked about multimodal interfaces. Many people think speech is just going to replace a keyboard, but that's not it at all. And I explained it to Steve on that first day. I said, look, if it's on a screen, the best way is to touch it. Directly manipulate that user interface through a mouse or a touch screen. And I said, the iPhone revolutionized touch because it added multi-touch, pinch and zoom and gestures. But as much as designers try to anticipate what a user wants on a screen, screens are small, they're limited. So many times what you want to do is off the screen. So you have to scroll or navigate or go through menus. The best way to get something that's off the screen functionality is to ask for it. And the perfect interface is multimodal, where you're touching and using a GUI graphical interface and asking all in the same conversation. That's our philosophy. And we want to do that for every app, for every web service, for every interface on every device. We want this notion, and that's what a perfect interface was. And Steve understood that and convinced us to join. There were three elements that I wanted from Apple. And that were factors. Number one is I considered Apple the best user interface company in the world. I mean, they really cared about user experience, like passionately. And I'm like, well, we're fundamentally a user experience technology. They have genius designers. This is going to be our technology with their designers. It's going to be incredible. Number two, Apple at the time had more credit cards than Amazon. And having to ask a user for a credit card to buy a movie ticket or to confirm a dinner or to buy something on Amazon, it's a barrier. So if we could just do purchasing and transactions, remember, we were a do engine. We wanted to get things done in the real world. And we just could use the iTunes credit card on file. Wow, that would be an amazing capability. And the third thing Apple had was the most ardent developers in the world. The Siri vision was always about an ecosystem. So very much like the iPhone was a platform. It came out of the box with 10 great apps, but then there was an app store where every developer in the world could create their own apps. And I always thought that if you have a personal assistant, a virtual personal assistant, you should be able to access any service that you wanted in this conversational way, customize it just like you customize your mobile experience. And that was the dream. But to do that, you need to get developers to buy in code for that new framework or platform. But Apple's developers, I'm like, wow, being a small independent startup, we were 20 people. It's tough to get developers to care. If we're part of Apple, they will care. So those were the three things I really wanted from Apple.
And those three considerations are amazing. I think they really resonate. The first point that you raised, how Apple really passionately cares about the user experience and consumer-centric designs and multimodal interfaces, I think it really speaks to that kind of synergy between Apple as a distributor for
Siri. Plus, we got to work with Steve Jobs, which he is one of the most iconic technologists of our age. And, you know,
yeah, except that you said no to him the first time.
No, well, we weren't looking to buy, but he was passionate. He was brilliant. And he said he understood what we were trying to do and would support us. And we're like, man, you can't find that in other partners that just do distribution like that is. So,
no,
again, we were not looking to be acquired originally. And we said no, but. Yeah. Ultimately, I don't regret the decision at all to have gone with Apple.
No,
I mean,
no.
It changed the world.
Of course, it did. It did. It really did. In our last chat, though, Adam, you know, we're discussing a little bit about reverse engineering your exit. Can you walk us through, you know, what you mean by that when it comes to entrepreneurship?
So the way I see it is you start a company and you incorporate and you say, okay, we have a number of shares that make up our company. You get half, I get right half. So now we're co-founders. We each, you know, it's worth maybe $500. From that moment, you want that company to be as small as you can. You file your tax documents, and then you want to make your company as valuable as possible. You start putting in come up with some patents. You start working on some software, business plan, because you're going to need to raise money, likely, to pay employees. And the more valuable your company is, if we can go from $500, but we add such incredible value, now it's worth $10 million. Now, if an investor is going to give us $1 million or $2 million, they're going to just get 20%. For $2 million at $10 million valuation, they get 20% of our company. But we get the money. That's our lifeblood. And that gives you the number of days until you die. Literally, it's your runway. Money equals time in entrepreneurship. And every day, okay, now we have five employees, you and me, and we're paying out this much every month, and we have this much money in the bank. You can see how long will it be until we run out of money. And so the goal is to produce, to be working really hard, get good employees, and to produce more value than we spent. Because when we run out of that money, we're going to need to raise more. And that valuation has to be at least twice as high as the previous step. So that means the next round, we need to raise at $20 million. And the round after that, we need to raise at least $40 million. And so it's an exponential curve. It's getting harder and harder because, you know, we're kind of working linearly, but the value has to be exponential. Now, the goal is a few. You need to either become profitable. The other is you could IPO or you could be acquired. In a sense, you get off the merry-go-round. So it goes around. Every time it goes around, that's another fundraising round, but it's doubling. It's going twice as fast every time. So you want to grab that brass ring before you're overtaken. As co-founders, you should know from day one, more or less, why are we doing this company? If Steve Jobs came up to you and said, I want to buy your company, do you say yes or no? And why? So when he said, I want to buy your company, we didn't have to look at each other. We had had that discussion at the birth of the company. You know, we had a plan. Another of my companies, Sentient, didn't have as good a plan. And they raised money round after round, but that exponential curve was going higher. And at one point, they raised something like $180 million at $800 million valuation. I'm like, $800 million? That means next round, when you run out of that, you know, $180 million, and you haven't reached profitability, you have to be valued at like $1.5 billion. You know how much revenue you need? Are you sure you can get to that revenue amount? That's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure. So that's an example of, you need a plan. You need to know, are we trying to exit? Do we want to get to profitability? Do we want IPO? You need alignment so that you don't want a situation where some co-founders say, sell, sell. And the others are like, no way. And then it becomes a story. We could be rich, but that's not what I want. I want impact. And you need to be aligned.
Totally right. No, totally right. And it really comes down to, you know, having that alignment across the board. Last two questions before we end our podcast. You know, Siri is used by hundreds of millions of users. Change.org has 450 million users. Adam, you have a knack for scalability. You know, how or why or what, you know, drives a product scalability?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Siri, we were a Techno and Viv, we're both technology companies. We anticipated the market, where it's going, and we got ahead of it. When the iPhone came out, many people thought the iPhone would fail. That was 2007. But in 2004, I sat down and I said, 2004, it's 10 years that the web has been in existence. I'm going to make 10 predictions for the next 10 years. And I did. And I worked for a month or two and put together a public presentation. And one of those predictions is that basically mobile is going to take off and there's going to be a new style of interface for interacting with all the web services and content in the cloud, which eventually was apps. So I had this belief and I thought that I was waiting for that to happen in the world. So when the iPhone came out, I'm like, that's it. I know this will be successful. But 2 years from now, well, every handset manufacturer, telco, will be desperate to compete with Apple. But what are the flaws of the iPhone? Well, the screen is still pretty small. The bandwidth was really slow. Every click on 3G was like 45 seconds to a minute, right? So if you have to get through a transactional flow, maybe it's 10 page views, that's like 10 minutes, right? And typing is hard, right? On that little soft keyboard. So I said, the Siri idea, that solves those problems. You don't have to type. Screen doesn't really matter much because it'll just answer you and tell you what the answer is. It gets it done. You say, book a reservation tomorrow night. It says, done in one round trip or two rounds. It shortens the time to task. So we built Siri to be the answer to what 2 years from now, the competitors to Apple were going to need. So technology, I think you anticipate where the world is going. That leverages, that gives you a superpower. You build ahead of the curve. Ahead of where we are today. And then right when that wave is cresting, you come out with this thing. Yep. And then there's a bidding frenzy and you sell to a distributor and that takes out all the risk. Apple had Samsung had a billion device footprint, a billion devices. With one push of the button, they can put our technology on a billion devices. So that's one way to scale. So, you know, anticipate the curve, build a technology for what's going to be needed by the time you finish, by actually building it 2 years from now or so, and then get it to a distribution partner. Change.org, very different kind of thing. This is a destination product. It's a standalone place. You go to a website. So you need to change behaviors yourself. Originally, Change.org was a social network for social activism. And we tried everything under the sun under that rubric. We had a giving platform. So if you gave $100 to a charity, your social network friends would see that and pitch in. So it would create a snowball effect. We ran the largest job board for social causes. We had a gifting platform that you could gift someone 1 square meter of rainforest. We tried everything, but we instrumented everything. We had incredible analytics, and we had this one little feature petition, and it started trending a little bit more. And so we moved it a bit more to the center and then made it a little bit bigger and then took away some of the other features and simplified the message. Eventually, the data, meaning the user's behavior, led us to what took off. And if you look at the growth of change.org, first 4 years, it was 1 million users, 1 million, 1 million, 1 million. 4 years of trying different things. Then it went 1 to 10. Oh, 10 to 25 year over year, 25 to 50, 50 to 100, 100 to 150, 250, 350, 450. You know, we managed to get the right combination of ingredients, and then the mass, the critical mass. Now people are seeing it. You know, change.org is mentioned on the news every day in various things or some cause. There's a critical mass that has to happen, and then you're a snowball rolling downhill and it's getting bigger and then you're scaling. But to get to that critical mass, it was try and try and try and try again. And it wasn't about technology. It's about getting all the little features just right. You know, if you send an email saying, here's a petition that you might be interested in, if you do a good job of that, you're like, yeah, that's interesting. Let me learn about that and I want to sign that. But if you do it a little too frequently, it becomes like spam and you're like, I don't want to, change.org is bothering me. Little things like that matter. And you have to tune and refine and study and try different things and analyze to get it just right to start that growth, that viral growth.
Yeah. I do think that, you know, the common factor behind the two, you know, examples that you mentioned is really about taking into account the landscape. What bigger conditions can you leverage on that can really drive the success of your product? Because part of success is it's also about how the product or the service or good that you have interacts with, you know, the macro conditions. And that leads me to the last question of the podcast, Adam. So Scalescape, when we're scaling a product, when we're bringing the product to the masses and we're building this, right, we need to take into account the landscape of things, right? The geography, yeah. The timing, product market fit. You know, what is there a latent demand for this product? So my last question to you is this, Adam. What is one tip that you have for entrepreneurs to scalescape their product towards success?
I guess my best tip is timing is important. The environment is important. And I made reference a little bit. I use this process called trends and triggers. So I literally, every once in a while, in fact, this is the year I'll be doing it again, I will sit down and I look around the landscape of what's going on. So like today, Bitcoin or crypto, is it going to be mainstream or is it going to be niche? Augmented reality, is it going to go mainstream or is it going to be niche? Everywhere you look, there are questions that might interest you. And if you're in different areas, you'll have your own things, you know, that are interesting. So when you have open questions that are not yet known yet, take the time to study and read and talk to people and think about it and make a bet, not a money bet, but a personal bet, a public bet to say, I think this is what's going to happen. And so I did, the first one I did was in 2004. I did 10 predictions for the next 10 years. Then in 2013 or so, I got up and I said, you know, some prognosticators only tell you the good predictions, the ones that came true. I'm going to show you the presentation I did almost 10 years ago. I'm going to score myself on how I did, and I'm going to make 5 predictions for the next 5 years. And some of those predictions were really, really good. One of my predictions in 2004 was that social networking was going to take off, you know, in a major mass market way. That was not obvious in 2004. You know, Facebook was just starting up as a tiny little thing. I had never heard of it at Harvard campus. LinkedIn was kind of a niche businessy thing. The largest social network was Friendster. But a year and a half later, MySpace became the number one most trafficked website in the US. And then Facebook came on gangbusters. And so that was like nailed that prediction. And I was like, not sure, but I had my reasons. So those are trends. Make predictions for where is the world going And then once you have those views, look for triggers. So for me, I gave an example of the iPhone came out. And it was one of those questions. Is it going to be popular or is it a fad? Is it going to be a success or is it a failure because Apple's not a phone company? And so I'm like, because I had my belief and I was waiting for it, I'm like, oh, this is going to be huge. So that trigger was like, now I know because the iPhone has happened, this confirms my belief. That means I clearly see what's going to happen in the next 2 years. So when you get that moment, It's like gold. It's like being able to predict the lottery number the day before. So I would say the best tip for entrepreneurs is you have to get the timing right and you want to catch that tsunami wave right at the crest. And if I had, you know, I had been working on Siri since 1993 was my first version. So if I had started it as a company anytime earlier, would have failed. If I had waited much longer, someone else probably would have done it. So timing is important. If you want to catch a tsunami style scale, you have to hit the timing. And that's my best tip. You have a trend and then a trigger, and then you have to be ready. Then you say, now that I know the world is doing what is needed, how do I leverage that lottery number that I now know?
That's amazing, Adam. Thank you so much for your time. I had such a great time talking to you today, and I'm sure that our audience is going to love this.
Yeah, thank you
so
much. Pleasure Adam. To be here.
I hope you enjoyed that really amazing episode with Adam, and I'll see you next time.